This is Central Time. Republican senators have officially dropped the latest effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Senator Mitch McConnell announced that they will not vote on a bill that was sponsored by fellow Republicans Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy.
Yesterday, Graham and Cassidy defended the bill at a CNN town hall-style debate against Democratic Senators Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar.
The bill was dead before the debate even began, but Republicans maintained their position on Obamacare. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham speaking last night.
Obamacare is failing, and I don't see a solution other than just throwing more money at insurance companies. I'm not going to do that. Do you get that? I'm not going to do it.
Ginger Gibson is a correspondent for Reuters, and she joins us now for the latest on the fight over health care on Capitol Hill. Ginger, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So as of right now, we're hearing that Senator Mitch McConnell has pulled the vote for the health care bill, effectively meaning the bill is dead. What was the nail in the coffin for this bill?
It seems that there was just, again, a failure to get enough support for this legislation. We saw folks like John McCain, like Rand Paul, like Susan Collins of Maine, all saying that they couldn't get behind this effort. When you don't have the votes, you know, it's a big blow to morale and to organization and to McConnell's leadership to put a bill on the floor that doesn't have the votes. So when the writing on the wall became clear that that support just wasn't there, they've admitted defeat before even holding a vote.
And you mentioned a few of the senators who were voting against the bill who had openly said that. What reasons did they give? I understand they're all a little different.
They are all a little different. We see folks like John McCain, who's saying the bill just doesn't do enough to provide protections for people who need it. We saw the same from Susan Collins. Rand Paul thought that it was still going to keep in place some of the problematic parts of the law and that he wouldn't be able to support that. So there was sort of a spectrum of opposition. We also know that some of the more conservative members that didn't think it was enough got on board, but we likely would have seen a lot of strain had a vote come up or had the bill been sent to the House, where you would have had more sort of conservative opposition for the legislation.
Now, this bill kind of sprang up quickly, and I know the Republicans were trying to get this in before the deadline at the end of September. Did the CBO have time to score this bill?
They did not. So you talked about that deadline. This is sort of a procedural loophole that closes on September 30th. They can't use that loophole after that, and that loophole allows them to pass the bill without any Democrats. Once that closes at the end of the month, they then have to start getting not only every Republican but several Democrats on board too. And they couldn't even get the Republicans. So the lift of getting Democrats on board is going to be even more difficult. And that was one of the complaints we heard from folks like Susan Collins, that without a CBO score, it couldn't be clear how many people would be affected exactly and how much it would cost. And we look at Republican primaries, look at Susan Collins, who's rumored to be considering a run for governor. These are the kind of things that come up in campaign attacks, where they say you voted for a bill without even knowing how much it would cost, right? Not even having enough time to have people read it. And that's criticism that many Republicans don't want to have.
Now, Senator John McCain played a pivotal role in the failure of many of these attempts, including this one. And Senator Graham was asked about President Trump's criticism of Senator McCain in opposing the last GOP repeal efforts. And here's what he had to say.
So Senator McCain has talked about a better process. John, if you're listening, if we fall short, we'll try to have a better process. Nobody respects you more than I do. So to any American who's got a problem with John McCain's vote, all I can tell you is that John McCain was willing to die for this country, and he can vote any way he wants to, and it doesn't matter to me.
Defense there from Senator Graham of Senator McCain. Can you talk a little bit, Ginger, about the role that Senator John McCain has played in these repeal and replace efforts?
Well, it's not an exaggeration to first start with the fact that John McCain and Lindsey Graham are actually like best friends. They're pals. John McCain's daughter once told me that she thinks of Lindsey Graham as her uncle when she was growing up. These are two men who are very, very close privately, personally with one another, outside of just the workings of the Senate. And so it's not surprising to see Lindsey Graham come to the defense of his good friend, a person he respects a good deal, even on a legislative matter. I think that there's a bit of personalities at play here, and we see that going on. The relationship between John McCain and President Trump has been very strained. It's been very difficult. John McCain was the subject of a number of Donald Trump's attacks during the election when he suggested that John McCain wasn't a hero because he had been a prisoner of war. I don't know that those wounds have never really healed on either side. You know, it continues to be that Donald Trump is not a fan of John McCain, and for apparent reasons, it continues to be that John McCain is not a fan of Donald Trump. And I think, you know, were they pals? Could they sit down and hash out a conversation and try to come to some common ground? You might see a different scenario playing out, but they're not. And that's really been an element in this whole process.
And McCain has called for more bipartisanship, more conversation and consensus in the Senate, more deliberative process involving both sides. Are there other Republicans who are calling for that?
Yes, we've seen a number of other Republicans say that the only option now is to sort of be bipartisan. That loophole closes at the end of the week. There's been some discussion about trying to open it again, but that could impede their ability to do tax reform. And so now they've got two big ticket items that they had said they were going to get done by the end of the year, that being the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and passing a comprehensive overhaul of the tax code that they may need to start talking to Democrats about. It becomes just simple math. If you need to get to 60 votes, you're going to have eight Democrats come along. And I think that we're going to see maybe a resignation that they need to do that. Republicans gave themselves almost an entire year to come up with a way to do this with just Republicans, and they couldn't get it done. And we've seen this in Congress many times for the past several years, particularly in the House, where they have controlled the chamber for a number of years now. And they just, when you can't strike a deal of your own members, then you have to start thinking about how to strike a deal with a broader, more bipartisan coalition.
Ginger Gibson's with us right now. She's a correspondent for Reuters, and we're looking at the latest effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which Republicans pulled the plug on today.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Are you disappointed or glad that the latest effort to repeal Obamacare fell short? Do you think Republicans should keep trying to do it? Do you think that there's room for Republicans to work across the aisle to improve the Affordable Care Act along with Democrats, or should it be left alone, or single payer? Should that be on the table? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll get to your questions and pick up our conversation in a little bit.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up the conversation with Ginger Gibson, correspondent for Reuters, looking at Republicans' decision to drop the latest effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
And you can react to that decision at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What did you think of the Republican Senate plan to replace the Affordable Care Act? Are you relieved or disappointed that it didn't move forward? Did you call a senator, Baldwin or Johnson, or if you're not from Wisconsin, from another state, to oppose or endorse the Republican health care replacement plan? What do you hope to see happen next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And Ginger, there was a town hall debate last night with Senators Sanders, Klobuchar, Graham, and Cassidy. Can you tell us what the tone was like?
I think we saw an attempt from Graham and Cassidy to make sort of a pitch for their bill, and we saw Sanders and Warren sort of making an argument for the idealistic. I think we're dealing with two sort of different universes. Graham and Cassidy are trying to craft a bill that can pass this United States Senate. Excuse me, whereas Sanders gets to talk about sort of a more broad and abstract terms, not something that would be concrete or passed at this day.
And during the campaign, some of Senator Sanders' ideas were sort of seen as liberal fantasy land, something that didn't have a lot of grounding in modern day politics. Are some of his ideas on healthcare seen as more feasible these days?
I think that he's getting a little bit more consideration of feasibility, but you have to remember that we're currently debating a plan to get rid of the previous, to go farther away from what Sanders wants and to get closer. It is said that in politics, most of the time, things can be very abrupt pendulum swings, so it doesn't make it an impossibility, but it does make it more difficult. He would argue that the solution to all of the problems is to implement his plan, and we heard him argue that on the campaign trail, but he didn't win the primary, and Democrats didn't win the general, and so if we look at what the voters opted for, it does appear to be a little even less realistic now than it was even a year ago when he was talking about it on the campaign trail.
Let's take a phone call now. We've got Katie joining us from Door County. Katie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
Well, I was just saying that I think that I'm very glad that all of this, you know, has stopped again with the Republicans just really trying very hard to do it their way, and that I think it is so past time for everybody to come together to work on this. That, you know, enough is enough. It needs to be bipartisan. The Affordable Care Act has its flaws. That's not a mystery, but it's not all broken. So I think it's time for them to figure out how to come together and fix this as a team.
Katie, thanks a lot for your thoughts there. Appreciate that. And looking at bipartisanship, we were talking about that a little earlier, Ginger. Do you think that's maybe more of a necessity going forward on healthcare, maybe other issues too, but certainly on healthcare? And does it also mean that we'll have to see working together from Democrats and Republicans to shore up the Affordable Care Act, since that is what is currently in place?
You know, I think that what we saw is Republicans who thought, well, they passed this bill without any Republicans so we can get rid of it without any Democrats, and turned out to find that it was much harder than they thought. I think that the numbers will start to be a problem. They're also going to have an election next year, and while it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to win either chamber, they could narrow the majorities. The Senate is very close, even though there's only a handful of Republicans up for re-election and only a handful that would be competitive races. But that's probably the fastest way to force bipartisanship, is to end up with chambers controlled by different parties. But there's they've tried, and there will surely be people within the Republican Party who will continue to insist that they don't need Democrats as long as they control both chambers. But it is every day proving to be an even more impossible task for them to get done.
We have to leave it there. Ginger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It was Ginger Gibson, a correspondent for Reuters. She was joining us to look at the latest Republican effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which was called off today by Republican Senator Mitch McConnell. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. During the height of shipping on the Great Lakes, thousands of vessels carried passengers and goods to Wisconsin's port cities. But the dangerous waters also sank hundreds of ships in Lake Michigan, and many of their wrecks remain remarkably well-preserved.
A proposal from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration would create a marine sanctuary on Lake Michigan covering about 1,000 square miles. It would help protect dozens of shipwrecks and also make it easier for the public to learn about their history.
Matt Cotto is the Education Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the area that would be covered by this proposed marine sanctuary. Where would this be?
So it's on the shores of Lake Michigan. It's roughly a little bit larger than 1,000 square miles from two rivers, Algoma to the north of where I am in Manitowoc, and down to Mequon in the Port Washington area.
And what's down there?
What we've got are some of the best preserved shipwrecks really in the world, and that has to do a lot with the geography and the conditions of the lake, and of course, why were we using the lake in the past. But these shipwrecks really tell a great story of how we've come together in this region as a people. A number of these wrecks are on the National Register of Historic Places because they play an important role in the nation's story as well, not just the regional story. So some really valuable cultural artifacts that are down there that we can use to enlighten not just students, but learners of all ages as to how we came together and the development of this area.
I know there's still shipping on the Great Lakes, but in this age of planes, trains, and automobiles, it's easy to forget how important the Great Lakes were as this transit system, carrying stuff. Can you talk about the economic role, the way these things were highways?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the 1800s, the easiest way to get, and really the most efficient way, to get into the Great Lakes region, to get into the Midwest and settle Wisconsin and beyond, was to move through the lakes. Of course, the road systems and things were not intact. So we were moving people, immigrants, who were seeking freedom from religious oppression and conflict over in Europe, as well as moving the goods back and forth to settle this area, as well as to make things in the Northeast and the East Coast move a little more smoothly as well, moving coal, lumber, grain, those sorts of things. And as you mentioned, it's still a really big thing today. You know, at its peak, we're talking a few thousand sailing vessels on the Great Lakes. So a lot of them out there, good chance for wrecks and things like that. And we've learned from that. And shipping today is still equally important. I think it was just yesterday that the Army Corps of Engineers announced another record load to go through the Sioux Locks this year, at a little over 75,000 tons. That's the equivalent of about 2,900 semi-trucks that were taking off the road to move this stuff. So it's still incredibly efficient. I think people today forget that this is still going on, and it's incredibly important to keep our economy moving.
And one great thing is we don't hear about shipwrecks all the time now, but can you talk about that element of risk and danger? I mean, looking at a shipwreck map of Lake Michigan, there were a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a ton of them, and a lot of that has to do, again, with the geography of the area. If we think about how the Great Lakes were formed and the glaciers kind of moving through, creating these depressions, you have rocky shoals within Lake Michigan that can cause problems. And, of course, we're talking about a time in wooden sailing ships where we don't have the best navigational maps. We haven't explored these waters, so the dangers of the waters during this period were incredibly unknown. And when you mix to that, the everybody knows the Gordon Lightfoot song about the Edmund Fitzgerald, right? The gales of November. Wicked storms can kick up here out of nowhere. So it's very, very treacherous for these boats back then. It's still pretty treacherous today. And when you think about the fact that there weren't a whole lot of regulations at that time in terms of how to safely navigate, to safely load ships and those kind of things, the dangers certainly were higher back then.
As I understand it, some of these shipwrecks are remarkably intact. Masts, in some cases, still sticking up. Hulls, not even necessarily breached. Can you talk about what we find down there when we go diving?
So what we find are really great opportunities to understand some of the shipbuilding that was taking place in the area, different techniques from different parts of the Great Lakes that we can explore. And we can really, again, like I was saying earlier, piece together the stories of how we came together as a people. A lot of these wrecks, as you can imagine, as we find them and begin the not only underwater investigation, but on land investigation through the historical records, can learn lessons, again, that we can apply today, I think. One of the stories that we like to tell here at the museum when we have school kids come through is the story of the Phoenix, which caught on fire on its way to Sheboygan. It had a number of Dutch immigrants who were seeking religious freedom. And this was one of those times, again, no real regulations, a fire caught, and a number of lives were lost. Everybody who was on board, every family that was on board, lost somebody, not no family was completely wiped out, I should say. But in some cases, you had children as young as third, fourth grade age who were now in a new world and alone and kind of on their own, needing to rely on the people of Sheboygan to really bring them in and help them create a life in the new world after that tragedy. That's not terribly different than things we see elsewhere in the world today when we talk about migration, particularly in the Mediterranean, is one that kids often bring up as a good parallel.
We're talking to Matt Cotto from the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc, looking at a proposed maritime reserve that would cover a lot of shipwrecks in Lake Michigan off the Wisconsin shores. And Matt, what would this preserve mean? What would change if this comes into being?
What's going to change, and particularly from the museum's point of view, is additional collaboration. We're a nonprofit 501c3. We rely heavily on collaboration to help not just the folks of Manitowoc and Northeast Wisconsin access this stuff, but we are the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. So we want to bring this information to the people of the state, the region, the nation, and the world. And, of course, that can be a difficult thing to do without this type of collaboration. So working with NOAA, working with the communities up and down the shoreline, and that's what's really great about this process. It's been community-driven and kind of a bottom-up process here, saying, hey, we all can leverage this and use this to improve our communities, the economy, the tourism, and the educational value that we're putting out. So bringing this together gives us additional opportunities to engage people with the content. And we've already started to do that a little bit. We brought up the Skyline Princess and started doing riverboat tours and taking people out into the sanctuary to talk about these wrecks. NOAA was up recently here for a couple of weeks at our museum to go out and do some lake bed mapping, which, of course, helps find potential wrecks because not all of the ones that we know are in this area have been found. But we can also then talk about some additional science. This is all sort of interrelated, which is the fun thing about maritime education. We're not just maritime history. Everything, it's interdisciplinary. It's all interconnected. So we've had students out, teachers out, who explore these. We had an ROV camp this summer where we were able to allow middle school students to operate a professional ROV and on the wreck, the Francis Hinton. And all of our campers were able to make visual contact with this wreck and this ROV, and you could see the gears turning and the inspiration really taking hold in these kids and understanding that there's some value here and potentially some career opportunity here as well.
ROV, remote operated vehicle, vessel?
Vehicle, correct, yes.
Okay, so these kids are getting to steer a water drone, basically, to look at these shipwrecks?
Exactly, exactly. And then, of course, that's part of, as I mentioned, it's a camp. So these kids spend a day and a half also working on the electrical engineering side of it, the buoyancy and the physics side of it, learning all of that, and also developing their own smaller ROVs that they get to then test out on land in a pool that we use as well. So it's really this interdisciplinary kind of thing that I was mentioning earlier. There's just so much that can be done with it.
Are there any questions about preservation of these shipwrecks? What kind of things are going on?
Yeah, the preservation, the Wisconsin Historical Society and NOAA, you know, they intend to co-manage this together, the state and the federal government. The efforts there really are going to be, you know, making sure people ideally aren't mooring directly to the shipwrecks to make sure that they're not damaged, the insertion of mooring buoys so they're accessible to the public who want to go out there and be able to dive on it. But in terms of preservation, you know, the law currently stands as, you know, anything that's on a shipwreck, it's the these are all state lands, the lake bottom, so they're all artifacts and property of the state of Wisconsin. Now, all the stuff has to be left there. Preservation, the fresh water, the cold fresh water, does a pretty good job there as well. So it's about access and interpretation, really. The maritime archaeologist Tammy Thompson and Caitlin Zant over at the Wisconsin Historical Society kind of handle the other side of that.
And I understand zebra mussels are maybe a threat to some of these shipwrecks.
They are certainly, it's a double-edged sword there, right? So they are... Zebra mussels aren't really the problem anymore. Quagga mussels have kind of taken over, very similar kind of invasive species, which is great that we bring that up because that's very connected to the use of the lakes and shipping and how we've opened up lock systems to the ocean. So it's a double-edged sword, because certainly they are encrusting themselves on these wrecks. It can make it harder to explore and study. But at the same time, these mussels, what they do is filter the lake water, making it significantly clearer than it has been, making it a little easier for divers to get down there and do their site mapping and discover these wrecks and explore them a little as well. So again, like I said, a double-edged sword with the mussels.
As we wrap up, Matt, what is the timeline? When could this preserve become a reality?
Everything is on track. The public comment is closed. NOAA is currently finishing up the final management plan based on public comment. And I think everybody's hoping that sometime early next year, ideally, we should hopefully have an announcement. I think that's everybody's hopes. And, you know, we'll see how things play out. There's certainly plenty of things in government that can delay these types of processes, but there's a lot of support here in the communities, and we're all very confident that it'll be moving forward next year.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Rob.
That was Matt Cotto, Education Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. He joined us for a look at shipwrecks on the Great Lakes and a proposed marine sanctuary in Lake Michigan that would help preserve their history.
There's